Shalom leYehudim, shalom leBnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. It's the evening of the sixth day, Gimel beChodesh Malcheshvan, Parashas Noach, Tafshin Pei 5780, the evening of the fifth day, Thursday, 31 October 2019, webcasting from the hills of Judea, struggling to survive the decadent culture of the left. So this week's brouhaha erupted two evenings ago in Petah Tikva at a rally in support of Prime Minister Netanyahu, defending himself against accusers who cannot distinguish between an imperfect person and a criminal who has wounded the state of Israel in some way. No charge like that has been leveled at him, really. Not surprisingly, another instance of post-Jewish Israeli culture. It is mimicking life in their true promised land, the United States. Today obsessed with accusing the president there of treason, with no basis for that either. And not only that, notice how Trump's accusers accuse him, have accused him of their own evil. There is video for all the world to see of Obama running for re-election, unaware of a hot mic and camera, telling the foreign minister of Russia in so many words he wanted to help Mr. Putin, but the elections force him to appear to care what the Americans think. But he would be more forthcoming and flexible after the election. It was the Russians who also forked over millions into the Clinton Foundation and paid King Billy the Kinky $500,000 for a 50-minute talk. Obama's fellow communist sympathizer, John Brennan, who ran the CIA, that's how corrupt the West has become, Brennan voted for the Communist Party in the 1970s and has been the most vicious in accusing Trump of being a Russian agent, who believably, I think, is also a secret convert to Obama's Islam, repeatedly on CNN. He has called Trump a traitor, because he's the traitor. And in Israel, the most vigorous enemies of Bibi are those who continue to accuse him from time to time, as in this high of the year, when we remember the Rabin assassination. They accuse him of inciting people to murder Rabin. This is the historical truth, quote-unquote, in the Rabin camp and their devotees, their way of thinking. And I find that simply shocking in its dishonesty. It implies, first of all, that Bibi spoke like a Hitler, shamelessly inciting people to murderous hatred. That can't be true, because Bibi's not an idiot. Even if he wanted Rabin to be assassinated, you don't speak like that in public, as they accuse him of doing. That's what the Israeli left accuses him of doing. And there at that rally on Tuesday night was Mordechai Kedar, professor at Bar-Ilan now, at that rally, who did speak openly a popular theory since 1995, popular on the right, that Yigal Amir did not kill Yitzhak Rabin, but a bodyguard did. Kedar called the true assassin a man with the same initials as Rabin, which people understand to refer to Yoram Rubin. But beyond the actual killer, Kedar said, quote, "The person behind this thing was apparently a leading politician who wanted to eliminate Yitzhak Rubin because he wanted to exit the Oslo Accords," close quote. Kedar went no further than that. It was not clear who he had in mind, but as I will mention later, I can see Uncle Shimon in that role. Kedar went on, quote, "For 24 years, the right has been tarnished. My Bar-Ilan University has been tarnished. We've all been tarnished. Yigal Amir didn't do it." Amir was a student there. "He is sitting in solitary confinement." Why solitary? "So that he won't tell the truth to anyone," close quote. Moti Kedar called for a real investigation of Rabin's murder, close quote. And for speaking this theory in public, his employers at Bar-Ilan University, I imagine their knees are knocking, demanded that he be called in for a reprimand when similar provocative opinions have been voiced by other Bar-Ilan professors who were never called in. Prime Minister Netanyahu instantaneously on Tuesday night disassociated himself from Kedar's remarks. The university likewise issued a serious rejection of his views as unrepresentative of the university. At first, it was misreported that Kadar was denied a trip by Bar-Ilan abroad to some conference as punishment, when later the truth came out that the trip was canceled a week ago for reasons having nothing to do with his remarks on Tuesday night. In any case, thousands of people have signed an online petition supporting Professor Kadar, formerly a 25-year veteran of IDF intelligence. If you have not had the pleasure, there's a YouTube of him on Al Jazeera in fluent Arabic, over 1 million hits. It's a hoot to watch him argue with and put down his Arab interviewer. I met him for the first time some 6 years ago, I think, five, six. We both spoke at a failed rally in TA for Israeli sovereignty in Judea and Samaria. On Tuesday evening in Petah Tikva, he told the crowd that top-secret documents concerning the assassination need to be declassified and made public, and made the obvious point that if they confirm the official story, no damage will be done. What is anybody afraid of? They will confirm that Yigal Amir was the sole assassin when Kadar thinks he is innocent. Well, yours truly is constitutionally allergic to conspiracy theories, because they always seem to propose complicated, super clever schemes and plots requiring a series of successes. So I have never doubted that Amir did what he claims he did and was convicted of doing. The alternate scenario depends on so many things that could have gone wrong. I prefer to apply Occam's razor, as it's called in philosophy. I opt for the simplest explanation, but where I do support Moti Kadar in his views is that Rabin was the target, politically, of the left at this point in his career, because by November 4, 1995, when he was murdered, this was 16 months after he and cohorts opened the doors to the country, to Arafat and tens of thousands of his barbaric anti-Semitic soulmates, and the terror atrocities that occurred since then in those 16 months had turned many Israelis against the Oslo scheme. Remember as well that the plan only passed in the Knesset with the help of the Arabs. Most Jewish MKs opposed it to begin with. And now there was fear among the plan's die-hard supporters, men like Uncle Shimon and his altar boy, Dr. Joseph Babin, Ph.D., and the nasty post-Jew pundits in the Israeli MSM. There was fear among them that Yitzhak Rabin was no less so shocked by the results, he was considering canceling Oslo. And in February 1995, I published a piece in The Outpost, the monthly newsletter of AFSI, Americans for a Safe Israel, that was mailed gratis, or I guess still is, to all members of Congress. I wrote a piece entitled Rabin's Palace Revolt. I'll read some or all of it. Well, we'll see what happens. And anyone who wants a PDF of this article, just email me and I'll send you a copy. The piece begins, and keep in mind I was writing in January 1995, quote, by mid-December 1994, ironically in the same week that Israel's prime and foreign ministers and their partners, Rabin, Peres, and Arafat, the chairman of the world's largest terrorist organization, were in Oslo, Norway, to receive their Nobel Peace Prizes, at home, dangerous signs of a rebellion in Israel's government were emerging, because most Israelis were not duped by those stupid peace prizes. That ghastly charade of a ceremony in Norway, notwithstanding, there was no peace in Israel, and the Israeli public was swinging sharply away from the government. The members of the ruling coalition of Labor and Meretz, otherwise known as the Jewish wing of the PLO, know this and were beginning to fear for the future of their schemes. Even as the farce macabre unfolded in Oslo, Rabin was putting the brakes on the so-called peace process, because Gaza-Jericho First, as it was called, had proven to be a failure. Fearful of more casualties, Rabin was calling a halt. Everyone could clearly see that all he and Peres and Balin had accomplished was to recreate the wild and woolly terrorist state within a state of southern Lebanon, 1970 to 1982, and relocate it just down the road from Tel Aviv, and some 30 minutes from Jerusalem. The security situation had deteriorated, and everyone knew it. Rabin admitted as much when he announced at that point that the next stage of the Oslo process would not proceed. Stage two called for more military withdrawals, but on a much grander scale, as a prelude to Arab elections, but Rabin rightly had no faith that people's lives would not be imperiled by a further retreat by the IDF. And because of his hesitancy, the Israeli left became anxious. Some of them had come to believe that they had in Rabin a perfect Manchurian candidate. And Othello to left-wing ideologue Yossi Yossarid Yago, Rabin's principal advisor on the PLO. In him, they had an Israeli general, most famous for his collapse in 1967, which followed his timidity in battle in 1948 and was followed by his retreat from Lebanon in 1985. This borderline alcoholic, known for a lifetime of psychological and military retreats, was actually putting the brakes on handing over Judea and Samaria to the PLO. This made the Israeli left edgy. Here was Rabin in retreat again, this time from his own Oslo peace process.
שחזר
And that was Psalm 126. Continuing then from what I wrote nearly a quarter century ago about Yitzhak Rabin, quote, I wrote, "The man's performance of late has given the left much concern. It's one thing for a brilliant right-wing journalist like Uri Dan to note Rabin's, quote, confused monologues, and eyesight, an item in Israel Shelanu newspaper, and his agitated performances after the murder of Nachshon Waxman, Zal, and 22 people in a bus in Tel Aviv. Uri Dan said there were worrisome signs of a possible, quote, short circuit between this man's brain and his mouth." And I add right now, Rabin was not verbally adept. It's another thing when Gidon Samet, in the article, a paragon of left-wing pieties, the deputy editor of the Haaretz newspaper, to shock the nation on December 23, 1994, by calling for Rabin's resignation, writing in Haaretz, which is a political and cultural clone of the New York Times, Gidon Samet judged Rabin to be a spent force. Although portraying himself as one of Yitzhak's earliest supporters, Samet said the time had come to signal, quote, the beginning of the end of Rabin, the navigator, close quote. Samet says, quote, hard decisions ahead, such as grasping the burning iron brand of uprooting settlements and speaking plainly and publicly about the coming Palestinian state, close quote. This is the last sentence I wrote. Bears a second look. In fear and trembling, because yours truly is not alone in never ceasing to be amazed and chilled by the depth to which the once anathema, conventional, worldwide wisdom of the 1970s and 80s, you know, the road to peace is a state west of the Jordan for the ancient Palestinian people, that has penetrated the minds of Israel's best and brightest. Sort of invasion of the body snatchers. In the above paragraph, the vice editor of Israel's New York Times was actually calling for the creation of a PLO state in Israel's backyard, and doing so as the height of wisdom, practicality, and morality. How frightening it is that so many of Israel's best and brightest have assimilated this non-Jewish wisdom. Samet is worried. He rightly observed that the Israeli street is not blind, and that the three recent displays of weakness by Rabin, in the manner of the land dispute at Efrat, a stock market tax, and cabinet appointments, have made him a liability. Shalom Yerushalmi, writing in Yediot Acharonot on January 6, 1995, also commented on the domestic crises and the burgeoning palace revolt. He noted the cabinet's newfound resistance to their chief's diktat. Many have been complaining they would no longer rubber-stamp Rabin's decisions. Why do self-styled proletarian socialists like Rabin, famous for preaching rule by committee and calling everyone comrade, are the least collegial, most Stalinist when it comes to power? Rabin's ministers now criticize him shamelessly, said Yerushalmi, and are no longer, as they were at the beginning of this government, interested in currying favor with the boss or preening oneself among one's peers as a friend of Yitzhak. Rabin is alone and increasingly under fire. Leftist Uzi Baram, minister of tourism, also reacted to Rabin's helmsmanship by saying, quote, "Those 2 weeks of the cabinet appointment of Eli Dayan's budget revolt and Efrat could be a fatal combination. I'm worried about the decline in Rabin's power. The time has come to change directions. This is our only chance to struggle with Bibi Netanyahu before the elections." On the surface, then, Rabin's erstwhile acolytes were complaining of his tendency to shoot from the hip, his clumsy verbal blasts at enemies, his failing strength obvious in the land dispute at Efrat. Samet harped on Rabin's age and doubted that he would have the youthful vigor necessary for the hard decisions, meaning uprooting Jews from their homes. But in the end, one suspects that these are not the real reasons the left is turning on him. Deeper inside these Israelis, like Samet, who have assimilated the mindset of a James Baker and his court Jew Richard Haas, is the unspoken fear that Rabin has shown himself really still faithful to the Alon plan of the Labor Party of 1967 and is not a true believer. No Manchurian candidate at all, Rabin recently asserted himself and shocked his backers by expressing his plan to retain the Jordan River as an Israeli border in a final settlement, with the implication of not handing over any more than 80% of Judea and Samaria to the PLO. This was in Israel Shelanu paper on January 13, 1995. Far more than his erratic vulgarisms and weakness, this is what terrifies the Israeli left most. People who insist the Arabs must have all of Judea and Samaria, the heart of the land of Israel, the religious heart of the Jewish people, and that all the Jews living in these areas be driven from their homes. Whatever Rabin's personal fate, his legacy to date remains freighted with accusations of reluctance to engage the enemy in 1948, his self-confessed psychological collapse in 1967, his retreat in Lebanon in 1985, his retreat from Gaza and Jericho in 1994, and heaven knows where else in the future. It's also a legacy of firing on fellow Jews in 1948 and killing more than a dozen in the Altalena incident. Much Jewish blood has already been spilled in the name of his peace. And although one has faith this madness can never succeed, the question remains how much more blood, a half century after the Holocaust, Jews must continue to spill until this pathetic man goes home. Close quote. So that's what I wrote 9 months before the assassination. And as I say, while I recoil imagining complicated James Bond-esque plots and maneuvers, I'm with Moti Kedar in entertaining the possibility of, as I said before, Uncle Shimon being capable of plotting Rabin's assassination in order to salvage his greatest achievement in life, de-Judaizing Israel, liberating it from the Jews, who are daily at that point reviving Judea and Samaria. I had seen him interviewed on PBS 2 years earlier, in early 1993, when in secret Dr. Balin and henchmen were meeting with the PLO monsters and plotting the future Oslo abomination. I saw Peres say at that time that the purpose of Zionism was normalizing the situation of the Jewish people, which meant living like all the Gentiles in the West, with a national identity separate from religion. Shimon Peres was also nicknamed by his rival Rabin in the Labor Party a tireless underminer, for in truth, Peres had a history of opposing whoever was the prime minister and going off on his own to sabotage the policy of the prime minister. Indeed, in the early months of Balin and pals meeting in secret with the PLO, authorized to do this by Peres, Peres never told Rabin, and only at the end presented him with the plan. I remember a photo of Peres earlier in his career shaking hands with French President Jacques Chirac, that old, tall, aristocratic Frenchman, into whose face Shimon looked like a starstruck teenager meeting some rock star. Peres also looked up to, later on, François Mitterrand, who advised him to do as the French had done in Algeria when they negotiated peace with the PLO, with the FLN, rather, and never mind that the FLN never threatened the existence of France and its right to exist. I imagine Peres had no greater thrill in his life than receiving the Nobel Prize from those equally tall and aristocratic Norwegians, those descendants of Vikings. Oslo, for Israeli leftists, was the end of being a people that dwells alone, the end of being the world's whipping boy for its abuse, mistreatment, and even cruelty of the ancient ones. The Nobel Prize was awarded to those two old Marxist-educated fools because they had surrendered the Zionist claim to the land of Israel. Unlike the first Zionists, who knew nothing of a West Bank, nothing of a Palestine without the entirety of the land from the river to the sea, Shimon and Yitzchak conceded it really belonged to the Palestinians, who were terribly wronged by our movement for national rebirth. Thank you. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. So we left off, and not for the first time, with the eternal sin of the Jewish people and its endless desire to be like all the Gentiles, loved by the Gentiles, which admittedly is understandable given the history of their murderous persecution, hatred, and abuse. That's why you want to be loved by them. And so on Tuesday, the municipality of Tel Aviv said that by year's end, presumably the Gentile year, fittingly Tel Aviv will begin poisoning the atmosphere, literally the air, on the Sabbath with the fumes of free public transportation. And that it will be free, I think, is the most important facet of the story. Remember, it was the previous enlightened Chief Justice of the High Court, actually bearing the name of Miriam Naor, which means enlightened, who in the name of the general human idea of live and let live, ruled that it was okay for small convenience stores in Tel Aviv on the Sabbath to do business. And now Tel Aviv has taken the next step and is proudly fixing to further violate the Sabbath by running public transportation, and significantly for free. Why for free? Well, it's to entice people to avail themselves of the opportunity to violate the Sabbath. It will cost the municipality millions of dollars every year, and even more when hooking up to other post-Jewish towns in the coastal plain with the same nefarious plan. Of course, the promoters of this violation of Tel Aviv's first mayor's views does not move them. They likely have no knowledge that the first mayor of Tel Aviv, Meir Dizengoff, who, although post-religious, respected the Sabbath as quintessentially Jewish behavior and understood its benefits. But today's Tel Avivians, of course, are lying to themselves. They think they're doing a good deed, providing a service for those without a car, so that they too can go to the beach in their bikinis like South Pacific pagans. The very name bikini reveals this. But I think the subconsciously, they're just flipping the bird at the Jewish religion. This is what really moves the crusader against Yiddishkeit mayor Ron Chollei and soulmates, for whom being an Israeli means no longer a Jew. Likewise, Yidiot today took note of the latest fashions in costumes in parts of Tel Aviv for Israeli children this day, this Halloween. You got that? Israelis, these are Israeli children marking Halloween, dressing up, children dressing up like witches and walking skeletons, carrying jack-o'-lanterns, with not one of these Jews in Tel Aviv, I doubt, knowing Halloween is Christian behavior. It's All Saints Eve. And the cast of characters are witches flying around on broomsticks, vampires like Dracula as a man, and Dracula as a bat. All of them a residue of pre-Christian European folklore, remnants of pagan Europe. Purim is not good enough for these cosmopolitans as a time for kids to have fun dressing up in costumes. They have to have Halloween as well, because that's what their kids are seeing, mesmerized by their communication devices and some other smartphones. It was those two Jewish cartoonists in the United States in the 1930s who dreamed up the figure of Superman, who fought for truth, justice, and the American way. What Israel needs is a figure who also strives after truth, justice, and the Jewish way.
הדרת פנים ואזכה שתזדכך חוכמתי 13 מידות שהתורה נדרשת בהן, ועל ידי זה יזדקך כל רינתי, ואכבד את השם מהוני ומגרוני. כבד השם מהונך, אל תקרא מהונך, אלא מגרונך, מגרונך, מגרונך. כבד השם מגרונך, מגרונך, מגרונך. כבד השם מגרונך. כל רינתי, ואכבד את השם מהוני ומגרוני. מהונך, מהונך, כבד השם מהונך, אל תקרא מהונך אלא מגרונך. כבד השם מגרונך, 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 כבד השם מגרונך.
Those words were from Likutei Mohoran, from Rabbi Nachman of Breslev. Okay, that's it for this webcast and for this week. I'll be back, God willing, after the Holy Sabbath. Until then, Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom, Me'eretz Yehuda.